What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We are live and direct. This is Law and Disorder on Pacifica Radio. I am Kalonji Changa filling in for one of our favorite hosts on the planet, Kat Brooks. Today, we have a very powerful show. We have a very packed show. And we wanted to make sure that we represent Law and Disorder well. So what better way to start off Law and Disorder today with, by having, some of our favorite attorneys on the planet. We have today from the NCBL, Attorney Maoli Davis, who is a renowned civil rights attorney, human rights organizer and author with over 30 years experience in movement for Black liberation. We also have Whitley Carpenter, who is senior criminal justice counsel and policy manager to Forward Justice. Whitley is the president of the NCBL and Maoli Davis is the president elect. Welcome to the platform. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you, brother. Excited to be here. Always excited to be able to share about NCBL and to rock with Sister Whitley.
Yeah, doing really good. Thank you for having us here. Really excited to talk to y'all and give you a little bit more information about NCBL.
No doubt. Honored to have you on. Whitley, it's our first time on the air together. I've been in the trenches with the Honorable Maoli Davis for over 20 years, watch him knock people out. So, I'm happy to be here with him today. It's always a pleasure and a treasure. For folks who are unfamiliar, NCBL, let's talk about it. What is the NCBL and why is the NCBL important?
Well, NCBL was actually created back in 1968 by a group of young Black lawyers who really saw law as a tool for liberation, which is what we're talking about right now, right? So for more than 50 years, NCBL has stood on the front lines of social justice. And so NCBL has defended activists like Angela Davis, like Assata Shakur. NCBL has fought for reparations. NCBL has and continues to fight against mass incarceration. NCBL fights to confront human rights issues here and across the world, right? And so as an organization, we have always identified ourselves as the legal arm for the Black liberation movement. And we want to include our whole community, right? So while we are lawyers, we also are really making a big push to include law students and pre-law students and community members, anybody that is about this fight for Black liberation and wants to work towards this racial justice that we're working towards. And I think what's unique about us that can maybe set us aside from some of the other bar associations and things that you see, in addition to just the inclusivity I'm talking about, is that we know that true justice isn't just about what really happens in the courtroom, but it's really about changing all the systems that create that inequity that we're talking about in the first place. So I'll be quiet. I'm going to pass to Maoli to add anything onto that, but that's what's special about NCBL to me.
No doubt. Attorney Davis.
Yeah, I love the work of NCBL because we are committed. And that commitment, what we're clear about, and you know this as an organizer and as a disruptor, is that we can't expect any justice in America without community engagement, support, protests, in addition to socially conscious lawyers and advocates. And so we never see ourselves outside of community. We just see ourselves as a part of community and the part that has to go into these hostile spaces and try to extract, to pull out some justice for our people, to try to navigate some of these most hostile environments. And that's the work of NCBL. So I'm grateful, that we convene annually, but we work continually. So we'll get together in Atlanta, starting today, tomorrow through Sunday. But man, the work that Whitley does, like her life work, is NCBL work, the work that Sister Jennifer Jones out in Colorado, that's life work. And so we have to be in a space with brothers and sisters and remind ourselves that we're not alone and that we're here as a part of a continued struggle that our founders in 1968 said that, you know, if you need Black lawyers, here we are. We're ready to, you know, stand tall.
No doubt. I really, 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 you know, I want to just say that, you know, I appreciate you all's commitment. One of the things that I definitely have witnessed from, you know, just Attorney Davis alone, just being here in Atlanta, you all change the paradigm, change the dynamic when you talk about attorneys, because oftentimes when folks talk about attorneys, they only think courtroom. And, you know, I've seen you all beat the pavement. You know, I've seen you all out in the community, in the streets, the people in the community, they know who you are. They know it's not just a situation that they see you when it's time to, you know, to just fight the system, like you said, like I said, behind those walls. What inspired you all to get down with the NCBL? Was it a natural thing just coming out of law school? Was it, you know, did you learn about it along the way? Or, I mean, what inspired you all to not only join, but to be committed and rise in the ranks of the NCBL?
For me, it was Chokwe Lumumba, period. When Baba Chokwe Lumumba came to Georgia State College of Law and spoke, that was it. That was it. And I was like, you know, when I first met him, I thought that I wanted to go to law school, but my godfather, Conrad Worrell from the National Black United Front, really introduced me to him. And I had just seen him, like, I think he was representing Tupac at the time. And here he was, this brother walking through the halls at a State of the Black Race conference in a dashiki. And, you know, he was tough, man. And I was like, you know, you can do this. And that really inspired me. You know, it's part of it is when you see that there's revolutionary work being done in spaces that, you know, that's questionable. Even with him, even thinking that electoral politics could play any role in helping us was me seeing him. So his legacy is very much a part of why I'm in NCBL and why I want to do my best to continue to build NCBL.
And for me, basically back in, I want to say 2018, because I'll be honest, I didn't know what NCBL was at first, but NCBL came to North Carolina back in 2018, and they were hosting an event at North Carolina Central Law School. One of my friends told me about it, said I should come out, and so I said, okay, why not? And I was able to see some other Black lawyers that were doing what it is that I wanted to do, what I was trying to, you know, figure out and lay the groundwork to do, not only for my career, but just, you know, my life in this fight for Black liberation. And to what you were saying earlier, honestly, it's not common that you see that in the legal field. It's not common that you see Black lawyers that are committed to this fight in the way that the lawyers are that are a part of NCBL. And so I knew this was a group that I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to figure out how I could, you know, contribute to it. And it just so happened that they were talking about, you know, trying to get intergenerational leadership within the organization and bring in some young leaders and some young members to continue expanding and building what the organization was. And so I found a home with my heroes and sheroes, as I like to say, of NCBL.
No doubt. You know, I appreciate you all sharing that. I want to know, for me, you know, as you may know, one of the main fights for us is political prisoners. So, and I know you all mentioned a couple political prisoners and exiles, ancestors, et cetera, who the NCBL has represented throughout the years. I want to know from you all, how important is political prisoner the fight for political prisoners to the work that you all do at NCBL?
I think it's critical because political prisoners are the forgotten ones. They're the ones who the rest of society and, you know, mainstream Black lawyers don't necessarily consider a high priority. And so, you know, the political prisoner fight is not just a fight in the courtroom. It's a fight for the consciousness of our community and how we continue to remind people that there are brothers and sisters who sacrificed it all to try to take a position about our liberation. And so it's critical. We have, again, members who take on these cases knowing that is not for the money, is not for any shine. It's just because we have to get them free. And we got to, as you like to remind us, we got to free them all. And so it's central to NCBL. I think from the very onset, political prisoners, reparations, those are those issues that were never mainstream that we've always been rooted in.
Yeah. Right on.
I don't have too much to add. I think he covered it, but the fight for political prisoners is really just central to our whole mission as an organization. It's the heart of what we do, right? I mentioned people like Angela Davis and Assata Shakur before, but you know, we want to stand with them all the way up to today's freedom fighters, because when the state, when our country is criminalizing resistance, it's our duty as Black lawyers to respond to that, right? And so I just think it's really about defending that right to struggle for justice, which is kind of the essence of what we do as an organization.
No doubt. Part of this, during this particular regime, how difficult has it been for the work of Black attorneys? Because we know that it's been a lot of pushback, a lot of nonsense under the Trump administration. I want to know, if has it affected you all's work? I mean, shutdowns and all types of things of that nature.
Willie, I'll let you go first on this one.
All right. I mean, I think my first response is that this work is always difficult in that there's going to be resistance. There's going to be pushback. This is not work that anybody, or I'm saying this is not work that this country really wants to be done, right? And so this administration certainly puts a different like public narrative on it. You think about funding, you think about the way that people respond as a whole, the political climate has shifted a little bit, but the political climate is never one for Black liberation in this country. It hasn't been. And so I think it's more of the same. It's just more of an intense version of it. You know, we're fighting back against more of a public narrative, whereas sometimes you may have a little bit more openness to some of the work that we're trying to do. But of course, we see all types of issues with just civil rights enforcement generally. Of course, you got fewer protections, you got, reduced oversight, that type of thing. And so it makes the space for this movement organizing that we're doing smaller. I think that just inspires us more, right? It just means we got to do more as an organization. It's why we are, you know, working so hard to put this conference together, to expand our base, to expand our membership, because we have to strengthen our legal advocacy, and we got to build deeper community, like allies and partners in these moments, so that we can really double down on our training of this next generation of legal warriors, because this is where we are right now. This is the world that we're in, the country that we're in. And so, if we're learning from those that came before us, the current administration is not a roadblock. It's more of an inspiration to keep doing what we're doing.
No question. We have a couple more minutes, and you both have mentioned the conference, and I like how you all, you know, you insert that, you know, like I was going to forget, but I want to talk about the conference. 56 years, that's a milestone, you know. We got the president elect. I know you all are busy. I've seen the I've seen the itinerary. I mean, man, y'all got like 88 things going on in 24 hours. Let's talk about this conference. Tell people why they need to be there or have some representation there.
Oh, for sure. For sure. We're excited. You know, folks come to the ATL, jump on a flight, drive. We just need to be in community in this moment. And so the conference is, it really addresses a number of areas. One, tonight we'll gather students at Clark Atlanta University just to be in conversation with some of our NCBLers that are coming around the country in early. So we just, this is almost like a, just, this is the pre-party, right? So we're going to get together with them at this intergenerational kind of conversation, get so they can learn how different people have come into the movement and see what entryway they have. So that's tonight. Then Thursday, we will have a continued legal education where we're going to be teaching lawyers how to try a civil rights case. Because the truth be told, civil rights cases, more are coming because more of our civil rights will be violated. And we need to be able to try the case and not, you know, plead it or continue it or, you know, basically decide that we don't have what it takes to finish it. No, so we're going to have that continued legal education on tomorrow. Then on Friday, a full, all kind of panels. We got reparations. We got immigration. We got political prisoners. We've got a special session with Professor Angie Porter from American University and my good friend, Dr. Greg Carr from Howard University. And they'll be discussing Africana legal studies and basically how do we incorporate an Africa-centered approach to what we do as lawyers. And then Friday night, we have a special session on Assata Shakur, and that's going to be incredible because the legendary Lennox Hines will be there. Brother Lennox was one of the attorneys who helped her aunt in her representation, who has been supportive of her as basically her legal counsel. He also had previously served as legal counsel, the U.S. legal counsel for Nelson Mandela. So this is a living legend. So he'll be there along with Deborah Jackson, who assisted him as a law student. We'll have April Albright. We'll have our Malcolm X grassroots movement elders who have been supportive of Sister Sada, Baba Kwame, Mama Chingaji. So that's going to be incredible. And then Saturday, another full day of really focused on young people, where we'll have panels that will include how the CIA, FBI have attacked rap music and hip hop. So we'll talk through that. We'll have a luncheon with Dr. Danny Black. He'll talk about storytelling as lawyers from, he's from Clark Atlanta University, incredible author. And then the icing on the cake will be at Pascal's Restaurant, where we'll have Dr. Baba Akinyele Omoja, who will talk about the legacy of Chokwe Lumumba and our need for NCBL to serve the Black radical tradition. And that's at 7 o'clock. So we encourage people to go to the website, ncbl.org, and just come through. Just fellowship with us. Come learn and help us, as Willie has already said, help us expand and continue to build our base, because there's so much work that needs to be done.
That's real heavy. Anything you want to add, Willie?
No, I think he covered it all. Just want to reiterate, it's not just lawyers. So lawyers, students, community, anybody that is in and around in Atlanta this week, please come and join us. You can register at ncbl.org. And even if you can't make it, that doesn't mean that you can't be a part of this, right? So just follow our work, follow us on social media. On Facebook, it's National Conference of Black Lawyers. On Instagram, it's NCBL_1968. We want to, again, build our base. And so support us as we continue this fight for justice.
Sounds real powerful. Really appreciate you all coming on. Definitely. What's that website again, Mowgli?
NCBL.org. NCBL.org. And Brother, we appreciate you. We're looking forward to you. And we didn't mention, we're looking forward to you being in conversation with former political prisoner Veronica Bowers Jr. So thank you, brother, for pulling up, for showing up. And we just are really looking forward to being inspired and learning from each other. And that's the beauty of it. And again, I just want to salute Whitley. And the North Carolina chapter really inspired Georgia for us to do more. So thank you to Whitley and the North Carolina chapter, NCBL. And we're looking to build chapters and rebuild, in some instances, chapters all over the country.
This is powerful. Looking forward to it. Honored to join you all. Will it be recorded for folks who are out in the Bay listening to this?
Some of it will be, and as you know, some of it won't be. So
okay,
you know,
okay.
they can flow from the Bay Area, man. We got
enough time.
Coast. Yeah, come on, jump on a flight, get out here, and get with us because we got to build together for sure.
No doubt. We'll see you all soon. Appreciate you all coming on. That was Attorney Molly Davis, Attorney Whitley Carpenter. Atlanta is where it's at this weekend. Make sure you check in, log in, and, you know, be on point. You're checking out Law and Disorder. This is Pacifica Radio. We're going to go to a quick radio break, and we'll be right back at you. Stay tuned.
Fire in your eye, that flood been coming true before the end of tonight. What will become of you? Sisters International, we birthing young men in ghettos to the faith that they can't handle it. We watching our streets and our systems eat them hoes. See, we have no scatter, we dancing our brains to steady slow now. We're dipping it low, playing the whole role. See, ghetto girls, Americana, the whole world is watching you. What we showing them, tell me, where we going in the universe is frozen and from here the point is boiling in. Ghetto women, generation hip-hop. We're riding up to ice, we got to make the snack stop. So we build that mob, then we get them to blow, blow, blow. Ghetto women,
have the good people. This is Law and Disorder. I am your host, riding for our sister Kat Brooks. This is Kalonji Changa. Law and Disorder, of course, is on Pacifica Radio. We're always happy to join Pacifica Radio for all the shenanigans, you know. And today is a great day to be in the neighborhood. We have another special guest coming on to talk about some of the things he's been doing. He is a political activist, an author, veteran leader of the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party. He's co-founded the Black Liberation Army. He's one of the Panther 21 defendants. And he's also an international correspondent for Black Power Media. We have none other than Daruba Ben-Wahad. Daruba, what's happening, my brother?
Power to the people. How you doing, Black man?
Man, let's hear it, man. I'm a live on arrival, man. You know, they got us on the West Coast together, brother. It's been a while.
Okay, I hear you. Well, give my regards to the comrades and folks out there, you know.
No doubt.
Don't let them get put on ice.
No doubt. Yeah, so always good to hear from you, and it's good to hear from you on these airwaves today. For folks who aren't familiar with your work, you know, as of late, you know, we mentioned the Panther Party, we mentioned the BLA. What are some of the other things that you've been doing as of late for folks who have been under a rock and haven't caught you?
Well, I've been ass out south of the Sahara on the eve of Armageddon. So I've been surviving south of the equator while folks back here in the U.S. are you know, tiptoeing into fascism. You know, okay. Eyes wide open.
Tiptoeing into fascism. That's a good way to put it. You know what I mean? So what does that mean for folks? Because of the fact that we're in a certain era. And keep in mind, we on the radio, I'm reminding you because of the fact that, you know, you always had the most beautiful, eloquent words. So I want to make sure, you know.
Well, you know, in America, nothing is sacred. Everything is profane. So, okay. but aside from my philosophical angst, I think that what I've been trying to work around and work with nationally and internationally is trying to forge a unified, a united front against the rise of white supremacist fascism and jingoism in the West, especially in the United States, because I'm born there, I'm from Harlem, and my history of struggle and has begun in the United States. However, I think it's very important to point out to the listeners, both on KPFA and abroad, that we are in a very delicate historical moment. Even the right-wing ethno-Christian nationalists recognize that this is a historical moment. It's a historical moment for them because they are under immense pressure and to relinquish their grip and hold on political and economic power. And it's a historical moment for those of us who are progressive, who are revolutionary, who are abolitionists. By abolitionists, I mean to abolish white supremacy and fascism and the racist settler states that thrive from this paradigm of power. But this is a historical moment for humanity in general as well. And when I say that, we are looking at the rewriting of a new world order, the reassessment of a new world order with the rise of the global South and BRICS, with the imminent demise and destruction of the last European settler state from the epoch, 100, 400 year epoch of settler states, which is the European settler state of Israel, the Zionist entity of this European settler state is under almost certain destruction, is facing certain destruction. And in their desperation they are committing wholesale genocide as we speak in Western Asia. They are pulling the United States and the European Union and its allies into a all or nothing conflict with those revolutionary forces in Western Asia, with Iran, with China, with all of the BRICS nations. This struggle is spreading like wildfire because of this desperation of empire. We have the Tangerine tyrant threatening Venezuela with overthrow of its government. Threatening the invasion of Nigeria to secure its over $30 billion oil refinery, in I believe the seventh largest producer of oil on the planet is Nigeria, exporter of oil. So, and we look at Venezuela, which of course has the largest oil reserves on earth, is in Venezuela. And we look at the United States sitting down, shaking hands as we speak with the former head of ISIS and these extremist elements that the United States and NATO created in Syria. So we are not in a good place now, because the desperation of empire means that they will do anything to keep their power and hegemony. The global elite will do anything, kill anybody to maintain their power. We see. I just wanted to conclude that in this process, in this historical moment, that the American people, the so-called American electorate, are in a precarious position. They have to choose morally between right and wrong, and they have to adopt a policy or a worldview that is based on truth rather than falsehood and distortions.
I know. So with that being said, and you know, the thing is, you and I, when we do interviews, we used to an hour, an hour and a half, 2 hours. But unfortunately, today we probably got about a good 3 minutes, right? So mm-hmm. I want one of the reasons we brought you on today is to talk about your involvement with the Fifth Pan-African Congress, which will take place in Ghana, in Accra, Ghana. So I want to, you know, for folks who don't know, you will be you know, along with, you know, with some of our other affiliates at the Black Power Media, you know, you'll be engaged in some of the work and some of the journalism as a special host over in Ghana. So I want you to talk about the Fifth Pan-African Congress and why it's important for you to be there, and the role that you're playing in a couple minutes, if you don't mind.
Okay, I only got a few minutes, I understand. The Fifth Pan-African Congress is being held in Ghana on the 17th and 18th of this month. I will be returning to Ghana Sunday morning, and I'm working with the socialist movement in Ghana in solidarity with other diaspora organizations. And the Fifth Pan-African Congress is really important because, as I pointed out, a U.S. hegemony and European hegemony and power in Africa is under severe attack by the youth, by the conscious elements in the African diaspora. We see recently in Zanzibar that the people overthrew the French stooge in Zanzibar, and the military sided with it. We see that the AES states, the Sahel Confederation of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, have set the tone for a new upsurge in Pan-African unity. All over the African continent, young people are rising up and challenging the political elite that have led them down this path of underdevelopment, debt, and rampant crime. So this Fifth Pan-African Congress is occurring at a very delicate moment, when the U.S. AFRICOM program is being dismantled and run out of Africa, when after the French have been invited to leave the Sahel nations, we have the massive humanitarian crisis in the Sudan that's being fed by the U.S., stoked by the U.S. through the UAE. We have Egypt siding with one side in that same conflict in the Sudan. And all of this is tied, of course, to the genocide in Western Asia and the inability of the genocidal a Zionist regime to conquer the Palestinian people and exile them from their own lands. So this is very strategic, because the Sudan has access to the Red Sea. The Sudan is of strategic importance to the U.S. allies, Arab allies, in their so-called Abraham Accord. So the Sudan is very important for this whole geopolitical paradigm of hegemony that the U.S. is trying to establish in Western Asia, and indeed in North Africa. So this Fifth Pan-African Congress is key. It's very important because this is for the first time we can consider the relevancy of the AU as a representative of African people. Africa is the youngest continent, has the youngest population on the planet Earth. The average age of Africans is under 30. So we have a very young population. We have a population that now is waking up to the effects of neocolonialism and subjection to white supremacist colonial economic debt, imposed debt from the IMF and the World Bank. And so these things are changing the complexion, the entire complexion of geopolitics of U.S. empire. And this is very important for Black people in the United States because we see little cracks in the duopoly political system. We see in New York the election of a purported social Democrat who had overwhelming young support and mass support. And this has thrown a monkey wrench into the consolidation efforts that the fascists are trying to implement with the dispersion of military and police into cities and states. Many of these cities and states are run by black mayors, have black city councils, and they're focusing on the so-called migrant problem, immigrant problem, so-called illegal immigrants. This is a phenomena that is plaguing the entire Western world. Donald Trump, the tangerine tyrant, at his address at the United Nations General Assembly recently told the world, and especially the Western nations, that if they don't close their borders to immigrants and migrants, that they're doomed. And so we see now that the global economy and the global imperialism of the West and of the white supremacist former colonizers is coming full circle. They have raped and pillaged the global South, and they have made the nations of the global South unlivable for most of its population. And these people are seeking a better life, and they're migrating to the metropoles of the former imperialists. They're migrating and immigrating to Europe, to the United States, and to other nations in the West. So this is a problem for the global elite, for who I call the Davros devils, who meet occasionally to determine how the world is supposed to run and how the global distribution of wealth is supposed to be managed. So this is a problem. So we have these geopolitical earthquakes and tsunamis happening all around the world. And all around the world, the global elite, the economic conditions that the U.S. and its allies set up in 1945 with the establishment of the United Nations, with the creation of the IMF and the World Bank, and the recognition of the Zionist settlers in Western Asia in 1948, this whole global edifice of law and trade and international law and trade is beginning to crumble. It's coming apart. And so that's what we're faced with. And we in the United States have a unique role to play in this because we are in the center. We are in the belly of the beast, so to speak. And our political leadership, our political representatives are silent. They're quiet. Mm-hmm. They have no analysis. They're trying to keep Black people inside of the Democratic Party when it's time for us to organize a separate and independent political party, a separate and independent political movement in the United States. And the war against fascism, the struggle against fascist police, militarized policing, and these cop cities is key to forming this new power paradigm, political paradigm in the U.S.
Aruba, we definitely, you know what I'm saying, we can go on and on because there's so much to talk about and so little time. And I think for me, I want to be self-critical and say it's disrespectful for me to have you come on and talk 5 minutes, because first of all, that ain't never happening, even if you and I was on the phone. But I want to say that, definitely, on behalf of Law and Disorder, this, of course, is Law and Disorder on Pacifica Radio. I want to say that we are honored, as far as Black Power Media, to have you as an observer and media representative at the 5th Pan-African Congress. And, we're looking forward to some feedback and report back on that. And, keep fighting a good fight. We got to run for a second. But like I said, till next time, we'll holler at you, my brother.
Okay, peace. And to all the comrades and those who are struggling on the right side of this historical barricade, power to the people. And, don't let down. Put the foot to the metal and pressure and stay in the streets and oppose these fascist goons who are running around snatching people off the streets and building prisons and detention centers. Because if they come for them in the morning, they will come for you and me at night.
No doubt, no doubt. That was Aruba Ben Wahad talking about the Fifth Pan-African Congress, along with so much more. We're going to definitely have him back on soon. For now, again, let me remind you once again, this is Law and Disorder, and we're on Pacifica Radio. And it is tradition for us to talk about political prisoners. And in order for us to, to top this show off, we definitely got to talk to one of our main men, a brother I had the opportunity to sit with for about 4 hours last year, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we have someone here today who is a filmmaker, memory worker, a writer and organizer for the mobilization for Mumia and several other groups in Philadelphia. We have John White. What's happening, John? How you doing?
I'm doing all right, y'all. Yeah, we're trying to escalate the issue of Mumia's innocence around Philadelphia, around Pennsylvania, and around the world right now, because Mumia is a leader in our communities, and we see the state consistently attack him to try to subvert a lot of the energy and a lot of the movements against neoliberal fascism that we're seeing internationally. And so right now, we're really calling all our brothers and sisters around the globe to rally around this march so that we can come together, push to get this brother out of prison so that we can continue to fight the good fight.
You mentioned the march. And I think that, for you and I, as I tell a lot of the comrades, we sometimes take for granted that everybody knows what we're talking about. But tell the folks what the march is about and why the march is important.
Sure. So on November 28th, we are launching a 12-day march from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to SEI Mahanoy, where Mumia Abu-Jamal is currently being held, to advocate for his release and to talk about elder abuse and medical abuse that our elders are facing in the carceral system right now. And so we're teaming up with a bunch of organizations and a bunch of affinity groups to try to come together and to mark out different legs of the march across 12 days, and then to meet him at SEI Mahanoy on December 9th, the fateful night that he was shot and framed for the murder of Daniel Falcon.
Definitely. And that's a very important date. And I'm glad that you introduced it as the commemoration of the shooting of Mumia and the framing of Mumia. because of the fact that that part is often left out when it comes to Western media. We hear about Daniel Faulkner. We hear about, you know, what his wife had to say and what the police union has to say and all that type of stuff. But when it comes to folks like Mumia Abu-Jamal, we leave out the fact that it was a shooting and a framing, just like the shooting and framing of our sister Asada Shakur, who recently made her transition on, who was shot on the New Jersey Turnpike. For folks who are unfamiliar, John, if you don't mind, give us a brief synopsis, a brief bio of who Mumia Abu-Jamal is and why it's important and what made you, what sparked your interest in becoming a part of this committee. For me, I can say that as far as my first movement or first introduction to movement as a individual was after seeing a Mumia poster. But, you know, we have a couple minutes. If you don't mind, just kind of give us an idea of who Mumia is and why he's important to us today.
Definitely. You know, I think maybe the introduction of my knowledge was through his work with the Black Panther Party. And I think what really drew me to that sort of study was the idea that the Black Panther Party was really a model of a group of people that were coming together to not only fight against the oppressive state of the oppressive police state in America and to try to create material good for our neighbors, for the other people under attack under these brutal systems, but that it was also a group that really developed leaders that went on to affect movement and change and work not just domestically, but internationally from there. And so I really grew with a desire to study out different individuals within the group. And Mumia Abu-Jamal specifically, he's a journalist, he's a writer, he was considered, like, I think his title was the Lieutenant of Information for the Black Panther Party. And essentially, this is a guy that is just trying to talk to people, regular people, about the sort of contradictions that we're facing being in the belly of the beast, in the Imperial Corps, dealing with the failures of Reconstruction and how they're and how the American dream, the American promise, has time and time again failed Black and brown individuals to the point that even from a very young age, that COINTELPRO is trying to surveil him and his life and upend any sort of message that he's bringing towards our movement. And
no doubt. I'm sorry, John. Yeah, we are out of time, but I definitely want to thank you for coming on. Make sure, folks, you check out this March for Mumia, which will take place November 28th. Till December 9th, and we will keep you all posted. I'm sure our sister Kat Brooks will keep you on deck. John, thank you for joining us today, my brother.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.